Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the studios of the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed, your host. Today's topic, Occupy Wall Street, a protest movement that's gone global. Let's listen to a sampling of what's been going on with these protests.
The Occupy Wall Street movement began in New York, quickly spreading across the U.S. to Los Angeles, Denver, and Washington, among others.
Here in Australia, protests have been going on now for just over a week.
It's since gone global, with Asia joining in the demands for change.
We're getting together in this park in Roppongi.
I'm here around the corner from the Johannesburg Stock Exchange.
In Europe, too, hundreds of cities are taking part in the protests.
We've had enough. That's the message being sent from many around the world to big business and government.
Has the spirit of the Arab Spring come to Wall Street?
Puzzling, bizarre protest.
The message still seems a bit scattered.
They're stealing from the poor and giving it all to the rich.
But what are they protesting?
Most Americans don't know enough about the movement to make an informed decision or whether or not they support Occupy Wall Street.
It's a joke. They just want to have a party. It's
I, for one, am increasingly concerned about the growing mobs occupying Wall Street and the other cities across the country.
People have taken their anger to the streets, saying their governments have been taken over by big business.
Activists living in the tents in Zuccotti Park, at the epicenter of New York City's financial district, appear to have little in common with the revolutionaries who risked their lives to occupy Cairo's Tahrir Square. The New Yorkers were inspired by the Arab Spring uprisings, and they're mimicking much of the nonviolent tactics and rhetoric of those demonstrations. But the Tunisians and Egyptians were far greater in number, and they had a clear objective, which they achieved in short order when their presidents stepped down. Occupy Wall Street was initiated by an activist group from across the continent in Western Canada. The movement is 6 weeks old and is leaderless. Its objectives are vague. They've come to call themselves the 99%, opposing the 1% of the U.S. population that controls 40% of the nation's wealth. The New Yorkers are also protesting economic inequality and corporate power over government. But Occupy Wall Street has managed to alter the political dialogue in the United States and capture the world's attention. OWS has inspired demonstrations demanding economic justice in about 70 major cities and 600 communities in the United States, in capitals from Western Europe to the Middle East and Asia, from South America to South Africa. 2 weeks ago, there were more than 1,000 Occupy events in nearly 90 countries. Another round of global populist protests are expected this weekend on the eve of the G20 summit in France. So why is this movement resonating around the world, and where is this movement heading? Here to give us insight about the Wall Street phenomenon, Occupy Wall Street phenomenon, are two well-traveled journalists. Kath Turner, she's a correspondent for Al Jazeera English based in New York City. Nicola Chadwick is a contributing reporter for Radio Netherlands worldwide. And Ben Dangle is the editor of Toward Freedom, which offers a progressive perspective on world events. Welcome everyone to the program.
Hello.
There were some violent clashes in a demonstration in Oakland this week, and clashes in Chicago over the weekend. Now, I want to talk with you guys about the protests that you've been covering. Kath, tell us what it's like in Zuccotti Square.
Well, David, at the moment, it's quite calm down in Zuccotti Park. It's been going for 6 weeks, as you said, and it's really, depending on which day you go, depending on which week you go down to Zuccotti Park, it's kind of a different feel. This is a movement that has ebbed and flowed and evolved and grown and shrunk from day to day. So at the moment, I would say, you know, I spoke to some of the protesters and organisers last night. They're quite sad and frustrated because of what happened in Oakland California a couple of nights ago with the violence with the police, with the tear gas. That's not what this movement is about, and they tell me that it saddens them to see that what they're trying to do, which is attract attention and force dialogue on and economic inequality, has turned into a conversation about police brutality and excessive force. The problem with that is it also attracts media attention for all the wrong reasons sometimes, because nothing better than tear gas and police in riot gear to create a headline, which is taking the attention away from what they're trying to talk about, which is that gap and that growing gap between the rich and the poor. This is a very, despite what many people say and think and like to generalize about, this is quite an organized movement. They do know what they're doing. They do know what they're trying to achieve. But it's the media's responsibility to report that accurately. I don't think that has been done very well in this country.
Oh, it's interesting. Nicola, tell us about the protests in Amsterdam.
Okay, the protest in Amsterdam is about 120 tents on the Stock Exchange Square, which is actually outside the old Stock Exchange. But it's a good atmosphere. It's well organized. There's a couple of large tents. Bands playing in the evening, there's speakers come, there's discussions. So it's okay. It's actually getting too big at the moment. It wants to move to the museum square, which would mean it could become three times as big.
Okay. Ben, you wrote a piece in The Guardian last week it's called From Argentina to Wall Street, and you talked about the similarities between the Occupy Wall Street movement and several movements in Latin America. Can you tell us about that and how they're protesting in Latin America?
I think one of the most striking aspects of this protest currently in the U.S. are the similarities to what happened in Argentina in 2001 and 2002 when that country went through an economic crisis, and people responded in a very similar way from the grassroots on up. When the banks closed, when people ran out of work, when there wasn't any food left to eat, people banded together and organized neighborhood assemblies, much like what's happening across the U.S. right now in the Occupy Wall Street movement. When the politicians failed, when the banks closed their doors, people looked to each other for solidarity and support, organizing barter fairs, making decisions collectively in a very similar leaderless fashion. And the same kind of inequality pushed people to the streets in Argentina that's pushing people to the streets in the U.S. today. And I think that there are a lot of similarities between these two movements because the same kind of capitalist policies ruined the economies in both countries. And the people that I've been interviewing and talking with in Argentina right now are saying, wow, this what's happening in the U.S. right now is a lot like what we went through in 2001 and 2002.
Yeah, let's talk about comparisons. How do the demonstrations abroad compare with the demonstrations in the United States? And also, why is it resonating so much? Why is it growing?
Well, in Argentina during that time, what really happened was that the poverty that was affecting the country expanded into the middle class, and that made the protests widespread. And I think a similar thing has happened in the U.S. right now. And also, there was a crisis of legitimacy in both countries, where people stopped looking to electoral politics, stopped looking to their bosses, stopped looking to leaders in different communities and nationwide for answers. And that crisis of legitimacy has pushed people to the streets to look for other alternatives. One of the things that took place in Argentina, notably, was the occupation of factories. When factories shut their doors during that time and put people out in the streets, workers banded together and occupied those factories and worked them collectively as cooperatives to survive. And we see a similar type of human-based action here in the U.S. when people are looking for solutions. There's also similarities to the neighborhood assemblies that took place in Argentina where people who didn't know each other, neighbors who didn't know each other, started talking to each other for the first time. And I think that aspect of community-based organizing and people coming together to look for solutions together is a very important fundamental similarity between the two protests.
Okay. Kath, how would you compare the Occupy Wall Street to the Arab Spring?
Well, I think there's been a lot of comparisons, and some people down at Zuccotti Park and Occupy Wall Street do tend to say that they've been inspired by what happened in Tunisia and Egypt. But when you really look closely, there's a lot more differences than similarities. Okay, yes, it is a people movement. It is born of a grassroots movement and people who, for there is nowhere else to go, as Ben said, but to each other because they've lost faith in the electoral system, the financial systems that are supposed to be set up to support them and every citizen of their own country. the main difference, of course, between Egypt and the Arab Spring and the United States is that the one is people in the United States are not being oppressed by a regime. There is no dictator in place. They are not being oppressed for more than 40 years. And people in the United States have genuinely have freedom of movement, of speech, and where they want to set up camp, as opposed to Tahrir Square. There are no tanks rolling into Zuccotti Park. There are not people being killed by live ammunition. That's just not happening. The other difference, of course, is that it was clear in the Arab Awakening and all the countries we've seen fallen in the Middle East that they want to depose their government, the regime. They want regime change. Here in the United States, it's a little broader, and there are mixed messages and multiple messages coming out of this Occupy Wall Street movement. It is fundamentally about economic inequality and financial and political systems that they say have failed. But there's a lot of different other, there is talk about joblessness, healthcare, the economy, the bank bailouts, because there are multiple strands coming from this Occupy Wall Street that's made it difficult for the media and for the general public to understand what exactly they want. Whereas in the Arab Spring, it was quite obvious what they wanted. They wanted freedom, they wanted a chance to elect their own government, and they wanted a freedom of movement and speech and choice, and they didn't have that. So I think while certainly there have been some people on that say, thank you, Egypt, thank you, Tahrir Square, for giving us inspiration, it's really only a motivational tool. There's not, I would say there's not many, too many similarities you can draw between the two apart from that.
Kathy, let me ask you this question, and Ben and Nicola, feel free to answer as well. Do you think this is a left or a right issue? Is it possible to label this?
It's not left, it's not right. Whether it's actually true, we have a very right-wing government in the Netherlands at the moment, and we're facing huge cuts. And the cuts are falling in certain sectors. They're not falling in big business. They're not falling in the rich areas. It's culture, the media, even the disabled are facing huge, huge cuts that are going to have a huge effect on their lives. We're kind of on the brink here. A lot of people are going to lose their jobs but haven't yet. So we kind of, we have a comfortable lifestyle, but at the same time, people know things are going to change. There's going to be huge cuts in government services.
Okay.
Things like teachers may be paid less, civil servants will lose their jobs. Even Radio Netherlands is going to be downsized by 70%, which is enormous, and that's got to start in January. So there's a kind of feeling here that people are on the brink of losing what they have, and the cuts are falling in the wrong places. Nobody minds cuts, but they would like them to be broader and fairer. And people feel inspired by the Arab Spring, but by the courage of people who could, yeah, many lost their lives fighting for freedom. And we have freedom here, but democracy doesn't seem to be enough.
Well, Kath, what's your opinion on this?
I would say this is almost an anti-political movement. It's easy to think that the Occupy Wall Street movement is a leftist movement because if you watch the way that the US cable and mainstream media has covered it, they do tend to lean towards the easy stereotype, which is the unemployed, perhaps the more hippie movement, if you like, and those who are, you know, anti-Republican. But when you really speak to these people, they don't believe in the Democrats particularly any more than the Republicans. They see the whole system, the US Congress, as essentially broken and unable to protect their basic citizens. So in that sense, they're not looking for a political solution. They're not looking for political influence at this point. I've asked them many times, are you here to rival the Tea Party? Are you going to be looking to endorse candidates in the election next year? They don't know. They don't want to talk about politics per se. They're not saying, yes, we are going to shake up the Republicans and, you know, show the party, Tea Party, how it's done. They've also lost faith in Barack Obama and his government. They think that he is also in Wall Street's pocket and that Wall Street's donating too much to his campaign. So I wouldn't say politically that this is any way left or right. This is just a fundamental, something is wrong and neither party has the solution. It's not up to these protesters to offer a solution either. They're not elected to do that, but their political leaning isn't obvious either. I've spoken to a lot of people who support both parties or neither, or independent. They don't know. They're floundering around and saying this system is broken.
Ben, is the sentiment similar in South America?
Well, I think in South America as well as in the U.S., and I've spent time at Zuccotti Park in New York and in Burlington, Vermont, and I think that this is a different kind of politics, a kind of politics of the street, a different kind of activist politics that indeed isn't looking to the Democrats or Republicans for answers because they haven't been able to come up with any answers. And I think it has empowered the left and brought a lot of people on the left I think this is a largely leftist movement where the kind of the left wing of the Democratic Party, socialists, anarchists, have finally come together in a mutual disdain for politics as usual. And they're looking for a kind of alternative way of searching for solutions here. And I think that both the way that the movement's organized and its demands are generally of a leftist nature, in the sense that they're against capitalism, against austerity measures, for debt relief, and for a kind of more human-based economy that doesn't look to give Wall Street money for ruining the economy. I think that those are fundamentally left values that do separate this movement from the Tea Party and other ideologies.
Okay. Now, before we continue our discussion, I want to remind everyone that you can view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcasts at globaljournalist.org. You can also find interesting articles, photos, and interviews related to today's program on our website. Please send us questions or comments via globaljournalistsprogram@gmail.com or our Facebook page. Now, Kath, I wanted to ask you, working for an Arab station, how have you been received in Zuccotti Park?
I think we've been received very well, is the easy answer to your question. We, Al Jazeera, particularly in the United States, has been demonized for a long time. We've been considered, you know, the terror channel and being a mouthpiece for bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. And I think that a lot of people turned to Al Jazeera during the Arab Spring and realized that we have a different way of reporting the news that doesn't necessarily come from a U.S.-centric point of view. We have Arab reporters on the street, people who understand and live in this culture and speak the language. And so when we go down to Zuccotti Park, they understand that Al Jazeera is trying to represent them in a respectful and an honest and accurate way. Al Jazeera does not have any political affiliation in this country. We don't have any corporate investment in this country either. So we are not beholden to any predisposed left or right or financial holdings. So when we go down there, they know that we're trying to present them in the best possible light. Or at least report accurately on what they're saying. So we've been received very well. I've seen a lot of hostility towards other networks, and generally when I go to ask someone a question, they say, where are you from? And I say, Al Jazeera, and they're more than happy to talk to us on camera and give us their point of view. So I think that the way we've reported previously on other uprisings and conflicts and movements like this has helped us gain access and have honesty with our people that we speak to, because they know we're trying to present them in the best way to an international audience.
I've noticed that Al Jazeera has had tremendous coverage on this issue. How does Al Jazeera's coverage compare with, for instance, the BBC or CNN?
I think the difference with our reporting, I work in a newsroom of three reporters, two other Americans, one's a Lebanese-American, another American, and myself, an Australian. And I think compared to the BBC, from what I see of BBC, generally of their reporting, is it's by the Brits, for the Brits. That kind of audience. They have some excellent journalists and really top-notch reporting, but they have catered to a very specific audience. Al Jazeera is a global network, and we have viewers and an audience right around the world, so we're not catering to any particular audience. Yes, our headquarters are in Doha, in Qatar, in the Middle East, but whenever I write a story, whenever I talk to people, I'm always thinking, all right, well, how does someone in Cape Town feel about this? How do I make this relatable to someone in Hungary or in Nairobi? And that is the challenge for me, but also our network, to make everything relatable to a global audience. And so when you look at CNN, that's particularly for an international audience, but also by an American reporter generally. And again, British reporters for a British audience from a British point of view. And I think that's what sets us apart, because we have different reporters from different backgrounds trying to relate a story on an international level. And that adds another layer or different angle to the story.
How are the Occupied Wall Street stories being received in the Arab countries? Have you got a feel for that?
Yeah, I mean, I think if, just judging from our feedback and from the website, I think there is a sense of universal solidarity when we see a movement like this go global. People very quickly to jump on it, and you know, Occupy Wall Street in New York is proud to be the birthplace of where this has happened, but and has referenced the Arab Spring. But conversely, the Arabs have also looked at the United States and what's happening in New York and said, yes, fight, stand up for your rights. This is what we achieved. We succeeded in toppling our regime, the dictator, the government we didn't want. You guys can do the same. There's no risk of Occupy Wall Street toppling Wall Street. That's not going to happen. But that solidarity of fighting against a system that they see as fundamentally unfair is certainly getting support from our Arab viewers. And they're also very interested in how this is happening in a first world country as opposed to an oppression in the Middle East and in a Middle Eastern country.
Okay, thank you. Nicola, let me ask you a similar question about Europe. I noticed that The Guardian has had wall-to-wall coverage on this, and some other newspapers have not. How has this been played in Europe, and how does it compare to other big stories like the Eurozone debt crisis, and how much coverage is it getting in print and broadcast?
Well, the Wall Street Occupy movement is getting quite a lot of coverage here since the people are arrested on the bridge. That was basically what made people look up. On the 17th of September, we had a very small demonstration in Amsterdam, also on the Stock Exchange Square, but nobody really knew why they were there, and nobody had heard of Occupy Wall Street. So that was kind of ignored, and it kind of fizzled out after a couple of days. But once the police started arresting 700 people on a bridge, it just really hit home here, and that's when it really started. The movement started to pick up in this country as well, and it's well received. People do feel sympathetic to it because nobody really knew that people at the top, people who were so rich, weren't paying tax. Nobody knew that, so it's a surprise, and it sort of shocks people to think, why am I paying tax when, you know, really rich people don't have to.
Ben, is this front page coverage? Is this a front page story in South America?
Yeah, it is. And a lot of people in South America and in the media coverage of this in South America have really been, the opinion has generally been, what took them so long? You know, the crisis in the U.S. has been so widespread and so profound. And a lot of people in Latin America who have gone through similar crises over the past 10 years, it didn't take this long to create such a massive protest. And I think another important similarity is that when these neoliberal or capitalist policies did destroy people's livelihoods, these protests emerged, and then it affected and in some ways created this wave of leftist victories across Latin America. There's about seven different countries in Latin America over the last 10 years that have left or left of center presidents elected. And the relationship between these protest movements and the governments have helped shift the region generally in a progressive direction. So I think it'll be interesting to see how the Occupy Wall Street movement in the U.S. Relates to the electoral processes or disassociates themselves from the electoral processes in this coming election year with Obama running.
Do you think, and anyone can answer this, that this is going to create long-lasting change, this movement? Or is this going to fizzle?
If protests continue and they get bigger, and the strength of these protests is that they're locally based. You don't have to go to Wall Street to protest. You don't have to go to G20 to protest. You can just go down the road and stand on a square and get a whole bunch of your friends to go with you. And if it grows in that way and people start noticing that there is a broad base for change, it could, but at the same time it could fizzle out.
I think that it's already been successful. Yeah, and I would agree that the fact that it's so dispersed across the U.S. and the world is an important aspect of this. I think it's been successful in that it's opened up the political imagination of America, a place that's been so closed-minded for so long in the realm of activism and political change. And even here in Burlington, Vermont, where I live, it's a small city, but for the first time, a lot of different disparate activist groups have finally come together and worked cohesively for weeks at a time and gotten to know each other and built coalitions. And the fact that so many of these movements and occupations are embracing collective processes and making decisions in assemblies means that they're reflecting the kind of world they'd like to see tomorrow in their practices today. And I think that profound transformation has already had a lasting impact on society.
Now, let's compare this movement to some of the other movements in the United States, the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement. Does this compare with them, and will this movement need a coherent message in order to succeed?
I think that there's been a lot of lessons that have been learned from the civil rights movement, from the anti-war movement in the 60s, and one of the benefits of the culture of the Occupy Wall Street movement is that it's drawn from so many different generations, people who have a lot of experience from the 60s and on, people who had experience in the anti-nuclear movements in the 80s, and sharing those experiences and lessons and failures with a younger generation of people who are very disenfranchised, facing a lot of debt, are very angry, and are looking to, you know, cross generations. I think that that's been one of the benefits of this movement right now.
Nicole, would you agree with that?
I'll be it. Would I agree with that? Sorry,
well,
can you ask?
How, I know that the and there have been movements in the United States that have spread to Europe.
I think people from my generation were starting to feel that young people didn't really care about anything and weren't really interested in politics. And now there's a sense that, hey, they're waking up. They do care about something. They do realize that their pensions aren't going to be there when they turn 65. Their jobs aren't going to be there when they're starting out. They're going to get into huge debt when they start studying. So there's a sense that people are waking up. So that it's similar. And I think the peace side of the movement is definitely inspired by civil rights and many of the other anti-war movements.
Okay, Nicole, thank you so much. We've come to the end of this week's edition of Global Journalists, and I'd like to thank the guest journalists who joined us today, Kath Turner from Al Jazeera, Nicola Chadwick from Radio Netherlands Worldwide, and Ben Dangle. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
I want to remind everyone again that you can view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcasts at globaljournalist.org. You can also find interesting articles, photos, and interviews related to today's program on our website. Please send us questions or comments via globaljournalistprogram@gmail.com or our Facebook page. Now, our director is Joe Deutschman. Pat Akers engineered the audio. Raymond Tungekar is our executive producer, and Jessica Popovac is the lead producer for this show, assisted by David Cawthorn and Ryan Kress. Thank you for listening and watching our program. And also, stay tuned for Free Press Watch.
And now, Free Press Watch, a segment on Global Journalist where each week we bring you a rundown of major events affecting press freedom around the world. I'm Raymond Tungekar. This week's report comes from the Committee to Protect Journalists. In Nigeria this week, Islamic militants claimed responsibility for the murder of a reporter and cameraman for the state-run Nigeria Television Authority. The reporter and cameraman, Zakaria Issa, was shot in front of his residence in Maiduguri on Saturday around 7:30 p.m. local time. An Islamist militant group is purported to be behind the attacks, according to local journalists in Asians France Presse. A spokesman for the group said in a statement that Issa was killed, quote, not because he was a journalist, but for his personal misconduct, end quote. In Thailand, the Committee to Protect Journalists is alarmed by reports that Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawatra's government is trying to censor the citizen journalist website Thai Flood. The site seeks to provide news and information about flooding that's affected a third of the country's provinces. Local news reports said the state-run Flood Relief Operations Command had issued a new requirement that Thai Flood submit its reports to the government for approval before publication. Emergency officials were apparently upset over one of the site's high water warnings, concerned that it could cause a panic. Yingluck's government has come under widespread media fire for its response to the natural disaster, which now threatens to inundate Bangkok. For more information on these and other events affecting press freedom around the world, please visit our website at globaljournalist.org. Thank you for joining us this week on Global Journalist. We'll see you next week.